I'm a mythical Pandora,
sent here to judge the universe.
Do you have any idea what the weapon is?
It could very well be a planet killer.
I would really like to go on this mission, Admiral.
Imagine having the power to annihilate entire worlds, and even the stars themselves.
Humanity is worth saving.
What have you done?
Pandora. New episodes premiere October 4th. Free next day only on the CW app.
New episodes of Pandora premiere every Sunday at 8 p.m. on the CW in the U.S., and you can watch it anytime on the CW app. Season 1 is now streaming for free on Amazon Prime. Welcome back to Unboxing Pandora, the podcast where we take a behind-the-scenes look into the hit CW show Pandora. My name is Peter Holmstrom. I'm the writer's assistant on the show. And today we are doing a recap, report card, post-mortem, I don't know what you call it, but it's a show where we look back on season 2 of Pandora. I have two amazing guests with me, the executive producers of the show, Mark A. Altman, Steve Crozier. Welcome, guys.
Welcome. Good to see you. Thanks for having us, and thanks for mentioning the A, because I was just looking at some stuff on social media where they did not put the A in Mark Altman, and I was annoyed.
That's very particular.
I think at this point, after two seasons, you get the fact that I use an A in my name, but that's just me.
That's fair. So at the time we're recording,
I never forget the A with him. Never.
Yes, it stands for
asshole.
That's
why we've been working together so long. All right, you said it, not me.
That's amazing.
It's so weird. I mean, you know, this whole season began with, you know, kind of me and Steve in a room with a blank sheet of paper and, you know, Tom on the phone. And here we are looking back now after this crazy year. You know, the last episode is aired of the season, hopefully not of the show. And it's a very strange sense of closure.
It has been quite a year. My first question is, I'd like to go back, way back to the very beginning. I think it's something that doesn't get mentioned enough.
It was a very delicate time.
It's a very delicate time, exactly. It doesn't get mentioned enough with Pandora is that this is, especially, and I think it's very educational for writers, who aspiring writers especially, who are looking to get into TV, is that Pandora is a completely original show. It's not based on a comic. It's not based on a pre-existing property. It's not a remake, it's not a reboot, whatever. And in this era that we live in, that's exceedingly rare. I wonder if you could talk a little bit, both of you guys, about the early days of pitching Pandora. How did you get it on the air?
Well, Steve, you want me to answer this one?
Go ahead, because I mean, we've always said it's amazing to get something original on the air, and you know, CW has a lot of things based on IPs. This wasn't, so it's amazing. So good for them to pick it up.
I got to tell you, it's a really good question. I appreciate the fact that you're acknowledging that this is not based on IP, because right before we started this podcast, we were just talking, Disney just announced 10 more Star Wars series, 10 more Marvel series. And you know, look, obviously I'm, as I'm sure you guys are, immensely excited about all the stuff that's going on right now in terms of these properties that I love being developed into TV series. But it's also scary for people like Steve and I and a lot of other writers, because of course, unless you're drafted, you know, to do one of these shows, to develop one of these shows, then the market for original material is really drying up. Nobody wants to risk it, you know? And I mean, I was just talking to some people over at HBO Max the other day, and I mean, really all they're going to be doing is like DC stuff. And, you know, and then, you know, at Disney Plus, it's Star Wars and Marvel and Pixar. And, you know, I'm so proud of the fact that we got an original sci-fi concept on the air. I mean, you look at all the big sci-fi programs this fall, Mando, you know, based on Star Wars, fantastic. Mm-hmm. You got The Expanse based on a very best-selling series of novels. Mm-hmm. And then you have the Star Trek shows, you know, which are based on this franchise called Star Trek loosely. So it's amazing to me that we were able to do this. And quite honestly, you know, Steve and I had a lot of properties that we were out with after Librarians and after we had done some feature work for a company that we'd done a TV show for. And we were out with some projects, but and this was not, high on the list of things. This wasn't something we were giving a lot of thought to. And as I've said before, there's that old Scotty expression, the right tool for the right job. And we knew CW was looking for original programming to fill out their summer slate. And one of the things that always stuck with me was the fact that Mark Pedowitz had once said that if he could show any of his competitors' series, he wanted a Star Trek show. And so, in our mind, this was kind of a Star Trek type of show, space adventure. And we thought that was the right thing to bring to them. But if I recall, we actually mentioned a few possible things. And this was the show that they gravitated to and they wanted to know more about. And we actually, it all happened very quick, which is funny in this business, because Steve and I, for instance, have another project that is based on IP that I think we've developed. And, it's been almost a year that it's been going on, and we don't even know, if that's going to happen or not happen. We have some other stuff that literally that looks like it could happen that have been, 3 years in the offing from the time they were optioned. Mm-hmm. And so this all happened extremely fast. I mean, they basically looked at some of the properties that we had and were interested in. They got excited about Pandora. They read Pandora, which was one, which was a spec script that we had done. And then, we actually cut a bit of a sizzle reel for the presentation. It was very early on that we brought on Crafty Apes as a partner to help with the visual effects to ensure that the visual effects would be great, because a sci-fi show is only as good as its visual effects. And, as we've said many times, the show was picked up in February. We were shooting in April, and we were on the air in July first season. Which is really extraordinary. And this is with no infrastructure. This is with no studio infrastructure. There's no like business affairs department. There's no, huge post-production pipeline. I mean, it was literally Steve. It started with Steve, me, and Tom Vitale. And that was it. And, we had to put together the deal with our wonderful partners at Starlings, who came on to deficit and cash flow the series. And, bringing on our whole post team, under the aegis of, the great Aaron Ratner, we brought on, it was Tom who suggested, meeting with, the boys in, Sophia, Jeff and, Phil, who, encouraged us to shoot the show and, Sophia, something that I'm not ashamed to admit we were initially a little loath to embrace, but they won us over, and I'm really glad they delivered everything they promised. And we were very lucky that all worked out. I mean, the amount of time we had to build sets was ridiculous. And the whole casting, we didn't even have a casting director. We found we found our casting director because Steve and I were in the showrunners training program, the Writers Guild showrunners training, and we have a bunch of friends who we're always calling each other for advice and recommendations and things. And I called a good friend of ours, Ryan Condell, who ran Colony, and he was really happy with his casting director. And I asked, what do you think of her? And he loved her. And then I talked to my friend Brannon, who had used her on something, and Erica Bream. And so based on their recommendations, we took a few other meetings, but we like Erica, we just, everyone loved. So we thought we'd, jive with her, and we did. She was fantastic. And then of course we had our local casting directors that were recommended by Phil Roth and Jeff in the UK, who also did a great job. So we were very lucky. There's so much that could have gone off
the rails. Outside of Priscilla, we met everyone else in person when we started filming.
Oh, wow.
Right. Had we not? Yeah, right. We hadn't even met Rochelle. It was literally Priscilla was the only person that we had met in LA, because everyone else was pretty much cast off tape, and we didn't meet until we were actually in, in Sophia filming, which was crazy.
We knew we were using John Kim. That's about it. So.
Right. And that was, that was a great experience. I mean, we knew we wanted to use John, but we also didn't know. Look, John knew nothing about what the show was. We didn't have a lot of money to pay him. So, Steve and I took him to lunch at Kay and Dave's in Culver City, you know, because we, you know, it wasn't Spago, you know, we didn't take them anywhere fancy, you know, that's not our thing. You know, we went somewhere sort of casual and fun, and we didn't even have to ply them with margaritas. We said, look, we're doing the show for the CW, and we were straight up. We said, we want to have you on the show for 3 episodes and kill you off, like they were planning with Matthew Fox on Lost. And everyone's right. Going to be really pissed and hopefully not want to stop watching the show. But, you know, you want to come and play. And he was like, I am so game. He said, I've dreamed of filming in Bulgaria. And we laughed. And he said, no, seriously. He said, it's one of the places I've never been. I've always wanted to shoot there. And we were thrilled. And it was so great because what he was able to do for the cast, a lot of them who were very green, who didn't have a lot of experience with American TV, you know, the stories he would tell about the librarians, and just in terms of his excitement and his energy, and, you know, I can't say enough good things about John Kim, and we're so lucky to have him as a friend and as a collaborator, and having him come back the second year was just a total blessing, and he was great. You know, he's been great on the show. He just elevates every episode he's in.
Well, I'm curious too. So season one ends, and I'm curious when it got renewed, I think pretty soon after the finale last October of 2019, and you started thinking about season two. I wonder what kind of lessons from season one were you aware of in the back of your mind that you could bring to the season two and its early development?
Well, the last episode aired, and then we went to New York Comic Con, not knowing if we were going to be picked up. And, you know, we did a panel. And that went good, well. And then we did a signing, which went really well. And we had Priscilla there, and we had Ben there, and we had Oliver there. And it was really great. And we figured even if we don't get picked up, this was a nice little bookend to the show. You know, this was fun. I was able to sort of take them around New York, where I'm from, and give them this tour of New York. It was sort of like in Hannah and Her Sisters when Sam Waterston is taking Carrie Fisher and Diane Wiest around New York. It was really great. And and I said, okay, you know, if we don't get picked up, we don't get picked up. We even recorded this video at the time, which was the cast talking about how excited they were about being picked up for second season, and we've been renewed and blah blah blah. And we banked it in the event we were picked up. But when we filmed it, we had
some of their best acting.
Some of their best acting, and then it was about 2 weeks later, which actually worked out great for you because a week before that, our writer's assistant took another job. Will Landman, and then we got picked up, and I got this really contrite call from Will apologizing for having taken the other job, and I laughed. I said, "Well, lucky dude, it was no idea. You know, we had no idea if we were going to get picked up. You did the right thing." And you know, he's like, "Oh, should I quit the job?" I'm like, "No, you can't quit the job. You'll be toxic." You know, and I said, "You know, hopefully we'll work together in the future. We'll find somebody else." And we were lucky enough to find you, Peter. So, but you know, we got renewed, and then it was a mad scramble because we were supposed to be shooting in February.
Yeah.
And Steve and I looked at the blank sheet of paper, and like, we had a couple of ideas. I think I mentioned recently, you know, Steve had let's do Space Trucker. Steven said, let's do Space Gladiator, because the sound mixes are very long. So half the time we sit there and we'll BS about what we would do next season if we get picked up. You know, I had a sense of where I wanted to go with the show. You know, Steve and I had always talked about wanting to tear down Osborne, you know, and not, you know, after him being sort of this arrogant, you know, guy in charge who treated everybody like they were disposable the first season, to really have his comeuppance the second season. We knew fairly early on that we wanted to bring Mata back, and then we were going to kill her. Mm-hmm. And that would send Raylan spiraling out of control for a couple episodes. And he'd have to rebound from that. And then the most important thing that we knew was that we wanted to bring Shay Kumar back as Jet. That was a very early decision, which no one believed in, with the exception of Steve and I. Steve really championed it more than anybody, I think. And I was, you know, totally on board after seeing the dailies on Akshay and Akshay and but you know, and Tom Vitale too was really on board with the whole idea. But I think it took a while to sort of convince people. And the great thing was when the network started seeing dailies on the first episode of season two, to their credit, they also were like, "This was a great decision." But you know, I don't think they necessarily felt as strongly about it as we did initially. Yeah.
Well, it's amazing.
Also, you know, story wise, what we did with him throughout the second season, I think really worked really well. You know, you maybe don't like him at first, and then you get to warm up to him, and then you see what he's capable of, and then what he becomes. So it's a good journey during the second season.
That was always the intention. And then I started giving interviews and talked about, oh, it's a meditation on cancel culture, which was never the intention initially. But I realized that our arc played very much into that narrative, the idea that this is somebody who did something terrible in their past, and should we just say they're dead to us? Or should we, if they're genuinely wanting to change, should we give them the chance to make amends? And that, you know, is at its very essence cancel culture, which is very much, you know, in the news right now. And so that became kind of a part of that arc in a sense too. You know, not that we ever said it outright, but you know, it certainly in my mind was, you know, it's like, when does somebody deserve a chance at redemption? And obviously, you know, we just loved him. And it was great because, you know, obviously Nicole, who didn't have a ton of experience, joined the show. And, you know, she was very nervous, and she was lucky to have somebody else new to the show who she could really lean on and sort of go through it together, because everyone else knew each other. They had these relationships and they're all super friendly and inviting, but still it's like, you want somebody who's going through the same experience you're going through. So it's like, they were both the freshmen, you know, surrounded by a bunch of sophomores.
Now, of course the season starts getting written in about December or so, and scripts are coming in. And then obviously a global pandemic hits. Curious about how that changed up things. Obviously it changed up things a lot, but in terms of, give us some of the pros, some of the cons that created.
Well, we had started writing, and you know, we've been writing, we'd done our writer's retreat, we'd done our writer's room, we'd done it, given a lot of assignments. I think, you know, we were first couple episodes were being outlined and were being written, you know, and I, you know, I, at one point, you know, I went to Sophia for prep. Me and Max, our DP, went to start prepping the season. And this was March. This was early March. And we're there for a little over a week. And, you know, suddenly they're shutting down the airports and the travel, and coronavirus is suddenly, you know, they're using the P word, pandemic. And so, you know, in the interest of safety, we shut everything down. And then, you know, Max and I scrambled to get out of Dodge. Unfortunately, when I got back, I got hit with the coronavirus. And so for the next month and a half, I pretty much didn't do much of anything. You know, I was in bed, you know, attempting to catch my breath. So, that was kind of rough. And then, but then all of a sudden we had another couple of months to keep writing. And I think it really benefited the show, because we didn't start shooting.
Yeah, that's definitely, the biggest pro was just the amount of time we could spend on the outlines, on writing. We didn't have that nearly the first season, so we definitely hunkered down here, and we just almost forgot about the pandemic for a little bit because it was so intensive between like working on the story arenas, the outlines, and the scripts constantly until we were going to figure out when we were going to start shooting again.
Yeah,
oh, and that's so interesting. Go ahead, Mark.
Well, I was just going to say that, you know, by the time we hit Sophia in July and June, every script except for 210 was written, you know, at least it was a draft. So we went in, you know, pretty much having the season written, we were able to crossboard, and we were able to do all these things we couldn't do first season. I mean, there were days first season, you know, where Steve and I, you know, were still writing the script a day before we shot, you know? So that was rough. That was really rough. And second season, we were in a much better position. And I think that's why, you know, second season is so much better than first season.
I'm curious, too, because season two has such a overarching story arc to it. And I'm curious if that was always in your mind from the word go, or was it something that evolved as the season progressed?
Well, I think, you know, we knew we wanted to be serialized. Like, the first season started out very episodic, and that was intentional. It was like, meet the characters. In each episode, you would meet a different character, right? The second one was Atreya, and the third one, you know, was kind of, was you know, with Xander's story, and then the fourth, you know, fourth episode was Xander's story. Fifth episode was Tom's story, you know, and then, you know, Pilar was the sixth episode. And then it started to become more serialized, and we started to get into the Pandora mythology on the back end of the first season. Second season, we knew we wanted to tell one story. And I think I mentioned this on the podcast for 210. The one thing we did with the finale, and I really consider 9 and 10 the finale together, it's late as one episode, is we did something we used to do on The Librarians, which we loved on Librarians, was we took all the pipe that had been laid during the earlier in the season and sort of paid it all off. So, you know, suddenly you have Captain Roy back, and the shell plays a part, and, you know, all this stuff that had, you know, sort of been planted earlier in the season turns out to be super important, you know, at the end of the season. That was something they liked to do on Librarians, which we really enjoyed seeing the way that your stuff that hadn't even been conceived to be part of the finale when it was written suddenly becomes, you know, all those pieces become part of that final story.
Yeah, I mean, Roy's sister Bertha was supposedly originally just mentioned in dialogue, and then we later on decided, let's meet her, and she's an important part of the mythology.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny.
Added in later.
I mean, I talked about this a little on the podcast, but I mean, when Steve wrote 207, he literally says, my twin sister Bertha. And because that's what she was. It was a throwaway line. It was never supposed to amount to anything. And it was later when Steve and I were just sort of bullshitting about what 210 would be. And we knew we wanted to bring Captain Roy back because we liked that character so much.
If the network didn't like him, he wasn't going to come back, but they liked him. So we thought, okay, we could do what we want to do with him now.
Yeah, exactly. And then we were really worried because we can't, you know, we started joking. Well, what if his sister was a Cronin? And once we stopped laughing, we started to think, wow, what if his sister was a Cronin? This could be fun. But then it was like, wow, is the network going to think this is ridiculous? But they loved it, which was great. It's always gratifying when, like, because there are a lot of things where you're like, oh, how's the network going to respond to this? Are they going to go for this? And, you know, we're really lucky. And I can't emphasize enough generally how supportive everyone at the CW has been for the show. I mean, we're a small show for them. We're not Batwoman. We're not Supernatural, obviously. So, you know, you wonder, oh, how much are they really going to care about, like, this little show that they use to plug holes in the schedule. And they, you know, treat us like, you know, we're freaking Arrow, you know, in terms of the attention and the love that we get from them, not in promotion, but in terms of the story from the current executives and the team, you know, our team over there, you know, who have really invested in the show being as good as it can in terms of the scripts, in terms of the, you know, the final cuts of the episodes. And, you know, they've always made no secret of the fact that they just love the show and they love the actors. And, you know, we've been very lucky that way, and that they've been very, very supportive. You know, our executives who bought the show are just wonderful. And, you know, that's been very, very satisfying for us. That part of the experience has been great.
Mm-hmm. Now, Steve, I'm curious because you co-wrote a number of episodes this year with a variety of different writers. I'm always curious about the nature of co-writing scripts with different people. How did you find that experience this year?
That's right. So, you know, Mark and I have done so much work together. So on number two, it was like we're back in the doing our old thing again. And so that was, we know, we complete each other's sentences. So that one was actually pretty fast. Working with Darren Scott, I've worked with him before last year, and I've worked with him before on another shows. So again, it's someone I've worked with before. And Bria, who I'd met last year, I knew her work, but we hadn't seen her before or worked with her before. So to team up with her, it was during the pandemic, and we, you know, kept in touch during the script, and it was really easy. So it was like faster, and, you know, TV writing is very collaborative. So you already have someone collaborating from the beginning rather than getting notes from everyone else or the network later on. but it was just a faster process, you know. And so all the collaborators, it all worked out.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Steve and I just have a shorthand, so it's very easy for Steve and I to write together. And, you know, I do feel like, you know, Steve's very good at collaborating with people and getting the best out of people. So, you know, for him, collaborating with people like Darren and Brea, you know, is very easy. And it's good for the show because he knows what the show needs to be and he knows what our limitations are, what we can do and we can't. So it was really helpful to have him. Those episodes came in very strong from the get-go.
Darren, we knew what we'd get out of Darren. We've worked with him before. So Brea, we weren't sure, you know, we were hoping it'd be good. Mm-hmm. And it really was, but you know, certainly we know what they could deliver, you know? So in Darren's case, we knew what he would get.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, as the season was filming for you guys, what were some of those pleasant surprises you found that you were able to incorporate into the scripting or into the storytelling process?
That's interesting.
That might be kind of a big question.
No. I mean, like, I don't know if this was a good thing. It ended up working out good. And we talked about this a little, I think, when Steve and I did the commentary on 205, that originally they were supposed to go to a Euphoria resort and it would have been this beach mm-hmm. world. And you know, we wanted to film in Greece and then it was going to be the Black Sea. And that all went away because of COVID and budget. So it ends up, now Aleka's coming to the school, you know? So, but I think that actually served that episode well. It certainly served the budget well. I think that, you know, I think we really loved Elizabeth Hamerton as Aleka. So obviously she became important to, you know, at that point she'd already been written into 6, but if she hadn't been good in 5, I don't know what we would have done. But then we knew when we saw her, we wanted to bring her back in 10 because we really liked her a lot. The performance and the person, the actor. And, I mean, you know, happy accidents. I mean, certainly the fact that when we were scouting for the fact that we found those beautiful gardens for 204 for Raylan's virtual reality fantasy, at the same time when we were scouting there, we found that great castle for 205. So that really helped us with that, you know, that really benefited the 205 by having, you know, Aleka's castle on Sumix.
There was a lot of reverse puzzles. It was like, how do we produce this show without, you know, going out on a million locations, you know, keeping it limited and actor availability with travel from back and forth from the UK. Like it was a lot more producing this year, I think, than last year.
Yeah, because we only had 5 location days. You know, part of that was COVID and part of that was money. So that was a real challenge, is like, how do you make the show not feel claustrophobic? And, you know, unfortunately, the only time I feel the show ever got claustrophobic, and this wasn't because of those issues, was the second episode, which I love, where they go to Clayton's mm-hmm. World. Because a lot of that was going to be shot outside, and we got hit with this torrential downpours. And so we had to move a lot of stuff into the cave set. And so it sort of became this network of tunnels. And inside this giant hollowed out mountain and temple and all this stuff. And
what opened that one up was Max and Chris Ledoux went out to Belogradchik Rocks and did drone shooting, which I thought at the time we would use in number 3, but we used most of it in number 2.
That was kind of a fuck up. I mean, like Steve finds these great locations and then, you know, we sent them out to do all this drone photography and, you know, and then the idea is how are we going to use that footage? It was sort of like I had shot a bunch of drone stuff of sunflower fields and stuff, which was completely, when we were shooting the factory for 201, I saw all these amazing sunflower and I'm just like, we got the drone. I'm going to go shoot this stuff. I don't know what we're going to use it for, but I'll figure it out. And it was the same thing. We shot this stuff up, this great stuff. And the plan had always been to use it for 203. But then we had all this cave stuff in 202. So we told the editor, why don't you use some of this footage to just open it up to show the visual effects guys what we want to do. And, you know, to show the mountain. And then it was also, we used a plate shot for the Kubrick landing. But the idea was never to actually use that footage of the fortress was supposed to stay for 203. But then the visual effects guys just kept all that footage and used it. And so like Chris was kind of, annoyed in his kind of, I'm not really annoyed, but I'm going to pretend I'm annoyed way, that he lost all that footage for 203 when, you know, he'd been shot specifically for his episode, and then it ended up all in 202. So that was partially where we get penalized for time, because I think that had we been able to move faster. Also, I mean, part of it was the drone footage was so wide and exterior and cool that it helped make up for the fact that everything was so interior in 202. And even when they're outside, it was green screen. You know, it wasn't like they were actually outside in the jungle.
Right.
So, so that was sort of an accident. It was a happy accident, I guess, but except for Chris. Because it doesn't really make sense, because you see the Kubrick lands and there's like this fortress. Would we never talk about it? Like there was this like alien civilization that probably lived on this planet, but we never talk about it because we were never really supposed to see anything like that. It was just supposed to be like they built this small Earth colony, you know, when they crashed, which, you know, makes sense when you see the mountain and the ship, but it makes no sense when you see the fortress. Then 203, there's this whole conversation about this ancient ruins and this fortress that we never see, because it was supposed to be the stuff that we used in 202. So I don't know.
Also, for a time, you know, originally before the schedule got shortened, 203 was supposed to shoot first before 201 and 202.
Right, of course.
And he was supposed to have like 8 days to shoot that, and it ended up that he ended up having 5 days. It was 5 or 6. I know it was 5. He ended up having 5 days to shoot 203 when he was originally supposed to have 8. So that wasn't ideal either. And that was a script that obviously went through a lot of changes, only because the visual effects supervisor was directing it and was kind of working very closely with Chris to see what he could and he couldn't do to make sure. Because, you know, originally there was like a flying creature that became the creature in the caves. And then it was also, we'd built these cave sets and we wanted to move more stuff into the caves because it's easier, quicker to shoot than being on location at that quarry where we shot the Asmodeus 6. So, you know, just, you know, again, I think it's much more challenging and in a way much more exciting to shoot a really low budget show than it is to shoot a high budget show, because a high budget show you can throw money at and solve any problem. We don't have money to shoot, so we have to be clever about how we figure this stuff out. And then, you know, somebody will say, oh, it looks cheap. Well, you know, guess what? It is cheap. So, but we haven't done our job, because the idea is it's cheap, but to make it not look cheap.
Well, and of course, this year was particularly challenging because of COVID and the heightened precautions that had to be taken on set, limited things,
well, that
and limited
affect us
the industry.
That affected us with the number of extras, although we did do some digital extra replication. And then, you know, on the first episode, we were really clever because we put them on a sort of Middle Eastern kind of desert world where everybody's wearing kind of, you know, this Moroccan kind of thing where their mouths and noses are covered. And
wearing masks to begin with.
Yeah. So that was, you know, that was very intentional, but it couldn't look intentional. So that was fun. But yeah, I mean, we, you know, it was tough on our, you know, with a lot of the crew of the Dauntless, it was this one extra pool that we would test every week, and we keep bringing the same people back, which actually worked for the Dauntless. The crew members are the same people week to week. But it, you know, so we had these people that we kind of owned for the whole season that we could keep bringing back. But, you know, also it meant you had like 6 or 7 people, and it was never going to be a lot more than that. So, you know, we had people sitting at all the consoles, and then at one point somebody said, oh, the bridge looks too empty. And we're like, well, the sound effects aren't in, but when they are, it's going to feel less empty. But we took that to heart, and then we started having more people crossing and doing stuff on the bridge. And, you know, I was always very sensitive to that, because I feel that Star Trek never looked cheaper than the third season of the original series when they cut the budget and stopped having extras walk around the hallways. Because you figure, oh, that's the easiest thing to cut. You know, it's like, oh, who needs these? But there's something intuitively that feels cheap when all of a sudden this big ship doesn't have a crew walking around anymore.
Right, exactly.
And then, you know, actor availability was more difficult because flying people back and forth to the UK couldn't do it as much. Obviously, back and forth to the US was very difficult.
And we lost some big yeah, that's a really good point. Because first season, one of the most fun things Steve and I had was the stunt casting. you know, having people like Mariam Diabo, having people like Jeff Combs, having people like Aaron Gray, which was probably our favorite, you know, having Manu Bennett. And second season, that all went out the window because we just couldn't fly people from the U.S. I mean, technically, people from America weren't even allowed to go to Europe, and we had to get exemptions for, you know, our cast, our principal cast, for our key producer, our key team.
Yeah, I arrived at the airport, and they saw the U.S. passport, and they freaked out, and I was the only American on the plane, and they kept me for a little bit. But we had all the paperwork to get in, but they were just very surprised to see anyone coming through.
It felt like I was in Midnight Express.
It's still the same. Yeah, it was very bizarre. It was very weird. It's like very weird. And, you know, the flights were extremely empty going both ways. It was very weird. Very weird time.
No, it was really crazy. I remember when I was flying back the first time and everybody was rushing to get out of Europe to come back to America. And like, I was watching Casablanca on the TV in the cabin. And it was like, I literally felt like, you know, I was fleeing, you know, from Casablanca, from Lisbon to get back to the, you know, the States, like in Casablanca. It was like, everybody was just pouring out like refugees. It was crazy. And then, you know, when we went back, like Steve said, the planes were completely empty. And except next to me, sitting next to me, of course, they had to put somebody next to me. And
I was in premium economy, and I was the only person. It was like a
bizarre
private plane. I watched Mad Max Fury Road thinking maybe this is what the world is going to become once I get back to America. I don't know.
But, you know, and the thing, once we got to Sofia, it was really great because people were wearing masks. You know, when they were in the supermarket, when they were around, you know, there was a lot of outdoor patio seating, which was the middle of summer, spring. So we were able to, you know, eat in restaurants and outdoors. And that it was so, after having been cooped up the whole time for pandemic, it was so nice to be able to go out with people and socialize. You forget how much you missed it. And, you know, one of the things, we had a lot of directors overlapping. So we would be able to take the directors out and they would get to sort of talk and come up with ideas and percolate, percolate ideas. And it was really, you know, I said this before, I mean, the team spirit, the esprit de corps on our show is really what makes it such a satisfying experience, and why, you know, despite the budget woes and, you know, the fact that nobody's making a ton of money off the show, it's so satisfying because we really have a great time making it. It's such a great group of people for the most part.
Yes.
I had to get "for the most part" in there.
Absolutely. Well, it is something I adore about this show and the working experience, is that we're all such fans ourselves, you know, and we just love the genre. We love what we're doing, and it creates such a shorthand and such a communal experience of the whole thing. And it's just fantastic. So I'm curious.
Breaking news, Patty Jenkins to direct new Star Wars movie, Rogue Squadron.
I'm not going to lie, Mark, I've been getting text messages all throughout this recording, and it's killing me that I can't look at them because it's
there's been a lot of news dropping. A lot of big news.
I've never met your son, but the little I know of him, I'm sure he's banging on your door right now because there's...
Oh my God, he's been counting down the days. He keeps going, he goes, tomorrow is the Disney Investor Conference. I'm like, you know, it's the first day to Hanukkah. He's like, Yeah, that's right. But it's the Disney event. They're going to make some big announcements. It's like, oh my God.
He's got his priorities right, in my opinion.
It's amazing. I think I read something. If you invested $10,000 in Disney in January, it would be worth $10,600 now.
Is that right?
Yeah. Well, because, you know, the stock went, you know, like a lot of things did in March, took a huge dip. So, you know,
right.
It's kind of gone back to where it was and then up a little bit. But
right.
That's cool. I'm a long-term Disney stockholder, for better or for worse. And, you know, I think they'll be able to navigate some of the missing things in their financials, you know, like
how long term are we talking about here, Steve? Is this like your retirement fund? Is this, because if it's over 20 years old, I imagine it's gone up so much by now.
Yeah, I originally bought it in 1998, I believe.
Wow.
But it used to be a very flat stock. It would be like $24. It had a pretty good dividend, but it would barely move. And then I bought more after they purchased Marvel, because I'm a big comic book fan. I thought, I don't know, it sounds like a good idea. And I bought more when they purchased Star Wars, Lucas.
Wow.
Look, Steve we've developed a couple of projects for a very big Hollywood producer. And Steve, for years, was always telling him how, you know, back when he was first getting the business, he told this guy, you should buy Marvel. This was when Marvel was worth nothing. You know, yes. They're just doing comic books and, you know, and he left. And every time we see him, he's like, man, Steve, I should have listened to you when you told me to buy Marvel.
It was the early 90s. He looked up the valuation. I missed out on a couple things. It was a show I worked on in the 90s, I don't know, around 2000 or something like that. And, this guy would come around set. He was a friend of the director, and this guy was—he had all these, internet startup things, and like he needed investors. I was like, I don't know, this sounds ridiculous, and a lot of his ideas probably were, but the one that actually worked was Twitter. And that guy was Biz Stone. Check out his net worth now.
So, well, I know a lot of people. The question people are probably asking in this episode is like, what's the deal with the third season? And, honestly, the honest answer is we don't know. You know, we're waiting to hear from the network. We hope, we had very tough competition in football and World Series, and, the ratings were what they were. I know we do extremely well on the app. We're lucky now that, we're also season one is on Amazon Prime, and season two will be coming to Amazon Prime streaming early next year. So, the show definitely has a big following. It's doing extremely well in the UK and Canada. So we're very cautiously optimistic for a third season. But, even if, CW were to decide that they were no longer in the Pandora business, we've had a lot of interest elsewhere. I'm hopeful that we'll be able to do another season or many more seasons, because we definitely have a strong sense of what we want to do. I think we laid the groundwork for a lot of that at the end of the finale, season finale, where we see that they're now, rogues. They're now wanted by the Earth Confederacy, which is, in league with the Zatarians. We don't know who to trust anymore. We're on our own. Tierney is now part of the central group, and there's a lot, we like to reinvent the show every season. I know to some people's chagrin, we like to change it up, for all you big, Pilar fans out there. But I'm sure next season it'll be the same. And I think that's what keeps you fresh and keeps it interesting. But one thing I can promise is, it'll be even bigger and better. And, Steve and I will never stop giving it 110%.
Well, let's talk a bit about season three. Everyone here who's listening, I hope you've watched the season finale. And if not, please go watch it before you go any further. But at the end of the season, Jack returns to the place from which she came, and theoretically that's the end for her. So when did that first come into your mind to say, like, let's really shake things up here at the end of season two?
Well, I think we always wanted to know, and Jax has really struggled through a lot of the season. She's confident at the beginning, and her faith was kind of shaken, and she sort of wasn't sure, and then she has this baby that's abducted. So, she's really gotten, shit kicked out of her. So at the end, we really wanted that strong, powerful Jax to come back to the fore and have to make, as I talked about, we also didn't want to string along this whole Pandora save the universe thing for seven seasons. Wanted to sort of resolve this, give the fans the satisfaction of having some closure to this storyline, but then say, hey, that doesn't mean it's the end of the series. There's all this other stuff going on. So that, the idea to answer some questions and ask new questions to keep it interesting, because, we all know what happens if you keep, juggling the ball in the air for too long, then people get tired and whatever answer you give them isn't going to be satisfying.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, what happened to Jax may have been foreshadowed in 203. What happened with Mata? She saw what happened. Everyone saw what happened. So it was, didn't know it was going to go that direction, but it was like, it could have, that was one of the options.
Steve, have you watched the finished episode yet? The finale?
Yes.
It's great, isn't it?
It's great. I mean, like you said, last year we had the last two episodes air back to back. These could have easily gone back to back. It's one great episode. Everyone's really good, and it's, you want to know what happens at the end there for sure.
I got so many texts after 9. I had people tell me how much they loved it and stealing the ship and all that stuff and how much fun that was, which was good. Because that's always one of my favorite scenes in Star Trek 3 was stealing the Enterprise. So I love that we did our little caper and people love the flashback. They love the flashback and finding out about Meredith Lucas and stuff. So that was nice. And then, you know, obviously 10 hasn't aired yet when we're recording this, but I think people find it very satisfying. I told you there were a lot of production issues with it, but I feel like we solved them in post. I think it's so. The best edit that we could have had of that episode. And I think with the special effects and this beautiful score and a little judicious ADR, it's a really, really cool episode.
And Mata's in there.
And Mata's in there. Yeah,
late edition. And like, you know, and the guy who plays Judson, the bellhop, is a great like local hire. Like, who knew like that guy? It was, I mean, this season especially, we benefited with local casting, I think, for sure. A lot of people like Xander's mother and obviously Judson. We did, you know, they brought in some really interesting people. And Mark, your favorite, Simon Feek. Got to mention this guy.
Yes, the great Simon Feek.
The great Simon Feek in episode 207.
I don't know what it was that I loved about him.
He could be back. He might be back next year.
Just that I think it's so rare that you you know, have like a blue collar type character in these shows. So I think that was part of what I really dug about Simon's performance. So okay, so here's the update. I guess the Willow TV series they announced, the Cassian Andor series, which is going to be called Andor. Don't love that name. Nope, the Acolyte, Rogue Squadron, a droid story, Star Wars, a droid story, Star Wars Lando miniseries, Rangers of the New Republic. What are Rangers?
It's a spinoff of The Mandalorian from what I'm hearing.
Oh, really? Oh, okay. And Children of Blood and Bone, but that's not Star Wars. I don't know what that is.
Ah, got it.
We'll find out when his podcast is over.
Yes, very I'm very excited for the Willow series. Very excited for the Willow series.
Yeah, if Disney's listening, Steve and I are always available to do Star Wars.
Exactly.
TV series.
They don't have any. Peter.
And the writer's assistant, too. I'm an encyclopedia of Star Wars.
You took the words right out of my mouth. Yeah, even if you don't hire us, you should hire Peter, because nobody knows more about Star Wars other than my son. So
thank you. It's fantastic. And it's been nice to see the ratings tick up a bit in the last few episodes, and that's hopeful.
It was a thankless job. We got thrown on in the fall. Nobody even knew new shows were on. We were up against new episodes of Simpsons, the World Series, NFL football, in the middle of the most interesting, compelling election season, you know, in 100 years.
Our hometown, we were up against, you know, the Dodgers. LA is a huge market, and they're in the World Series. And it was the first time they won since the 80s. So it's like, it's a tough to get eyeballs. And like Mark was saying, for sure, everyone's watching live news, you know. So I think even everything overall scripted might have gone down a little bit. But
Everything scripted went down a huge amount. But, you know, also, I think that's one of the reasons we're really doing well on the app. I know we're doing extremely well on Amazon, which is great. So people are discovering the show. They're digging the show. But I also hear from a lot of people, they've never heard of the show. So, you know, it's incumbent upon obviously us, the people who make the show, but as well as the fans, to let people know it exists and to spread the word and get people to check it out, because that's the only way to ensure a bright future for Pandora. But I'm very optimistic about what the future holds, I have to say. Yeah. And again, it's been a great experience, great partners. You know, we probably, obviously, you know, our other executive producers, Tom Vitale, couldn't have done the show without him. Amazing. His knowledge of science fiction and his love for science fiction, and just been fantastic partner for Steve and I.
Tom creatively, I mean, Tom was involved in every script. He read them all, gave us notes. You know, it's like we all worked on all the scripts, you know, at the end of the day. It was all collaborative. We all gave each other notes before.
Amazing collaboration. You know, we talked about Max, our fabulous DP, I mean, who just gives it 110%, just so invested in the show and has given it its very unique look and worked so hard. And he did such a great job directing the season, you know, a script written by you and Lisa Klink. So it's just been, you know, like I said, it's a great team, you know, and all our great production team and Sophia, who've done such a wonderful job and have really raised their game. You know, I think their desire to deliver, you know, everyone just gives as much as they can and more because they really believe in the show. They work so hard and it's not always easy, but it's great. And then we have this just terrific cast, you know, really, really wonderful people.
It's truly been the best year of my life, and it's a testament to the show, and
not
it's
many
just been a fantastic
2020.
I mean, that's fair. That's very fair, but it's it's just been absolutely fantastic. And
yeah, you should probably keep that to yourself, Peter.
I'll edit all this out, I suppose. But
everyone remembers their first. Hopefully you'll have many more. But like, I remember my first produced credit. It's a big deal, and you know, steamroll off of it and keep succeeding, because you know, it's these working out here is about career. It's not just like a one off. So Absolutely. We want to see more from you.
I want to see more from me too.
You only have one first credit. So you now at a very young age have your first produced network.
Yeah,
TV
network.
Credit.
Yeah, no. Yeah. It's crazy.
It's not some shitty cable station. You got network TV credit.
Yeah. So let's take a few seconds just to look ahead to season 3. What are you guys hoping for? Obviously we hope to get renewed, but what do you hope?
My biggest hope right now.
What do you hope to see in season 3?
Well, I want to see the show continue to evolve. I think we're always, you know, in a good position when we focus on character, you know, character, character, character. You know, the rest of it is all window dressing. So, you know, I want to deepen the characters. I mean, I think we've been promising to deal a little bit with Xander's drinking. You know, that's something I think we want to deal with the next season. You know, I think that we want to turn the show on its head again. And I think we want to do the unexpected. I think that you're going to see a lot more in space and probably less at the school again. That seems to be where the show wants to live. I think that, you know, we played around with a lot of different genres. We did comedy, we did Western. You know, I'd like to do more of that. I'm hoping we can convince John Kim to come back, for another couple episodes if we're lucky. Mm-hmm. I want to get back to having maybe some cool stunt casting, if the pandemic, abates, you know, but I want to keep up the spirit of adventure and excitement and fun that this show does while also having something to say. You know, we're not a Star Trek show, but I think we have the Star Trek spirit in that we're a show that's inherently optimistic and hopeful, you know, extols the value of family and of science and of working together. And that's something that is in the DNA of the series. And I certainly hope it's something that will continue in season 3 and beyond.
Amazing. Steve,
and more cameos for Steve Crozier.
Right. If you pay attention closely in the second season, you'll see 4 cameos by me. So I'd like to at least do 5 or more in season 3.
He's still waiting for those royalty checks to come in. That's...
Well, maybe we'll get a trading card. That would be enough.
There we go.
That would be exciting. Or an action figure. Yeah.
Yeah, an action figure. Yeah, exactly. Oh,
fantastic.
My God.
And for me, I really hope to see Mata come back because I love her and just want her character to come back somehow.
Mata? You know, we love Tegan.
All of them.
And Tegan did such a great job as Mata this season. She had, you know, really tough to step into a role that another actor had done. And she just took it by the throat and made it her own. And it was so hard to say goodbye to her. You know, we always knew we wanted to get rid of her, you know, not get rid of her, but you know, the character was going to die in episode 3, but then she'd have one more episode after that, which I think is just such a great storyline where Raylan doesn't want to let her go and creates her in virtual reality. But we love Tegan. She's great. And it's really hard. I mean, you read about how Scott Gimple and the Walking Dead people, you know, how hard it is for them to say goodbye, you know, all these people they're killing all the time. And you know, you really become a family, and it's the same thing with us. It's we've killed off a lot of people, some we've brought back, but
right, we're not a show that gets rid of people because we don't like them. There's some shows that are like that. I think a lot of the decisions were made before we even cast the person. Their storylines were already kind of set. So
very true.
Yeah. but we do, we, you know, and I'm sure we'll have some new cast members next season. We've talked about, you know, some new cast that we want to introduce, and that, you know, that'll be, that's always fun to find new regulars, you know.
Simon Feig working in the engine room of the Dauntless.
Simon Feig is the engineer. We got to talk about that.
That's fantastic.
That's awesome.
Fantastic.
So anyway, well, but Peter, thank you for this great job you've done on the podcast all season long. It's been fantastic. You've talked to so many people who are instrumental to the success of the show, like the composers, the cast, the DP, the writers, the directors.
We got to give a shout out to Brett Simmons, who was co-producer on the show, directed the first two episodes, did a kick-ass job the first season.
Brett's the best.
I didn't overlap with him like I did last year, so it was, that was the biggest bummer, I think, of this year, which I didn't have any overlap time with Sophia with Brett. So it was awesome to have him back again, for sure.
So indebted to him for his hard work and his good taste, and just, you know, all the directors this season were great and all completely different, you know, from Brett to Bria to
Buddy. Chris LeDoux,
amazing. Chris LeDoux did an amazing job under very difficult circumstances. And, you know, as soon as he took off his director's hat, he was back creating amazing visual effects for us. So just everyone just delivered and worked so hard. And we're very, very lucky, very lucky.
And we're hopeful for a season 3 so we can do it all again.
Indeed, we are. But until then, I need to get at least a couple of weeks sleep.
Only a couple, though, Mark. We got to get back to work very quickly.
The Zoom calls with the actors about, you know, talking about how they're excited about how season 3 is happening, because it worked last year.
Yeah, right. Exactly. we got to record that and have that standing by for if there's an announcement to be made in the coming weeks.
Awesome. So with that, we'll wrap things up. Mark, Steve, thanks for being here, and thanks for humoring me with my digression into the behind-the-scenes stories of Pandora with this podcast.
Well, this was great, but now I got to go read up on the Disney Investor Conference.
So let's get off this call then very quickly.
Maybe it's up in after hours.
And I have to hit Steve up for a loan here, I guess, pretty soon. all right, guys. So this was fantastic. Listeners out there, thank you again for joining us. This podcast was a labor of love for me and for all of us on the show. So thank you for being here. And I hope you enjoyed season 2 of Pandora. And if you liked it, please do hop on to IMDb and give the episodes and the series a good rating. So I hope we can do it again. I hope there's a season 3, and I hope I can be here to talk you through behind-the-scenes stories for that season as well. So for myself, Mark, Steve, have a good rest of the year, a good new year, and hope to join you again soon on Unboxing Pandora.